Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf of the Cordoba Initiative. Imam Faisal has been one of those promoting interfaith dialogue, or at least discussion between religions, particularly Islam and the West, at the World's Parliament of Religions. Imam Faisal, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Pleased to be here in Australia again.
One of the themes you picked up today was the way in which so much of the discussion that we're having about Islam in the West is related to local communities. And those local communities are going through patterns which we've actually seen before.
Yes.
They are not unusual.
No, they're not new. I haven't studied the pattern of faith community or religious communities immigrating to Australia, but I've studied them certainly in the United States. And I discovered through my research and reading over the years that the phenomena that we are witnessing today in the United States, and I think it's fair to say probably in Australia as well, is something that happened in the past when the Jewish communities from Eastern Europe and the Catholics mainly from Ireland and Italy immigrated to the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries.
What we saw then were people who were coming into a new country, bringing both a religion and a culture. And often the collision was with the culture as much as it was with the faith.
In the case of Muslims, we are seeing distinctly a culture from various parts of what we call the traditional Muslim world, from Morocco, let's say, to Indonesia. But when the Irish were, you know, came to the United States, they were whites. There was not an ethnic problem there. When the Jews came to the United States, they were also whites. They were all Europeans. The issue, and in many cases, it wasn't even culture so much as the tradition, as the faith identity, rather. In other words, the problem that we have seen not so long ago in Ireland between the Irish Catholics and the Irish Protestants was not a cultural issue, but it was a very, very major issue of conflict. So we can see how just the mere religious identity in and of itself alone can create a sense of the other that may be threatening to the dominant community or who that feels that its identity is being impacted adversely.
It's a question of teasing out what there is about that otherness that is most threatening and finding accommodations. Now, some of that otherness may be related deeply to the nature of the faith tradition that's coming in. Other aspects of that otherness may be simply cultural accretions from the society from which the immigrant group have come. For example, when Greek Christians first began moving to Australia after the Second World War, coming from the southern Mediterranean, many of them wore scarves. So the older women wore black as they were widowed throughout their life. And there was a bit of sort of cultural antagonism. This is back in the early 1950s in Australia, because people said, look, these people coming in here are so different. But it soon emerged that it wasn't a profoundly religious thing that was being lived out here. It was something that had come out of the Mediterranean culture. And eventually the cultural bits and pieces were able to be shaved away or modified, and people over a generation become quite accustomed to that. So now it's not even thought of, even though Greek Orthodox churches are quite different from Catholic churches or Protestant churches. It's a non-issue. And it is the problem of identifying what's central and what's peripheral, both for the new culture and the old culture.
Indeed. John, I believe that most human beings are not really as intellectual as even they like to think themselves of being, even when they think of them, when they are in fact intellectual. We are more driven by our emotions. We are emotional people. We react emotionally. When we like something or we feel comfortable with something, we can lead our minds via our emotions. So we need to look at what it is that creates this sense of fear or threat. My sense is that we all have individual and collective identities. The identity can be anything. And you can create conflict, and we love to create conflicts even in terms of, let's say, football team rivalries. You know, if you are a Manchester United fan, and you know, as an Arsenal fan. Now, let's not go those Arsenal guys over here. Let's go that rugby team over here. I mean, this idea of social identity is the core issue, and how that identity is defined and shaped by a given group is the core question. So what do we mean, let's say, by being Australian today? At one time, Australian may have meant being white, being Church of England. But then as Australians felt comfortable with a sense of identity that was multicultural, as we call it today, Australians today have a very different view of what it means to be a proper Australian. So the sense of propriety of the national identity or the group identity of of Australianness is now much broader. It encompasses different religions, different ethnicities, different skin colorings, and so forth. So we need to look at the identity as to how it was originally defined and how it continued to be broadened and shaped. Now, in the United States, it took a different narrative. In the United States, at one time, the proper thing was to be white, Anglo-Saxon, and Protestant. And going back 100 years ago or more, ecumenical dialogue at that time meant understanding between the Methodists and the Episcopalians and the Baptists and the Lutherans and so forth. The Catholics were not even considered part of the family. They were considered beyond the pale at that point in time. And it was not until the 20th century, until the middle of the 20th century, that America accepted Jews and Catholics, and they went into what they call the Judeo-Christian ethic. So the Protestant ethic, which were, you know, that terminology which was first written of by the sociologist Max Weber, which was the ethic of the United States, became now a Judeo-Christian ethic because we needed to include the Catholics and the Jews as well. Well, now we have Muslims and we have Hindus and we have Buddhists, so what kind of an ethic does America have today? So I think this kind of discourse is always a discourse, an ongoing discourse, that is being conducted by nations and societies and communities. And in a globalized world today, we need to re-examine the nature of identities and group identities and national identities and how we can create a global multiculturalism. And this is why I find Australia extremely exciting, because I think Australia, in some ways, has led the way and is showing us the way.
There's an interesting history of this tradition in Australia, in that if we go back to the 1890s, the Australians who were here in the 1890s, when there were proposals for solving the problems of the poor in England, that they should be come out here and ships sponsored to come out, local people in Australia didn't want the slums of the poor of London polluting the new bright cities of Australia. So, and then in Australia, in the 1917s, 1920s, there was a great fear of Asia. We don't want the yellow peril. So that every culture, as you indicate, has this need to protect itself, but also begins to crack open, and cultures tend to swing. The most recent example is that in Switzerland, where you've had a citizen-initiated referenda, which has led to a ban on the construction of minarets and mosques. There's this tension between popularism and the need for politicians to deal with popular sentiment and a discussion which may be apparently academic but does have some visceral connections.
Indeed. As I pointed out in our session earlier today in the World Parliament, or the Parliament of World Religions here in Melbourne, there's no actual Islamic requirement for minarets. You know, that's what makes it kind of like a kind of a... God is laughing up there watching this whole thing, you know, unfold. The attachment that we have to certain symbols are understandable, but they're not fundamental. Many of the most important mosques, ancient mosques, had no minarets. So there's a fear aspect to that we understand. And the cause of the concern in Switzerland, as it is in other parts of Europe, is that the national identities of those countries are being shifted demographically by the fact that the traditional societies and communities are not breeding enough to maintain their societies. They have an economic need to have imported labor. But how do you deal with the imported labor, and how do you incorporate them into your society as citizens or citizens-to-be or as residents whose fundamental human rights need to be protected? And that's the underlying dynamics of the discourse. But also, I think it behooves us to recognize, and I even talk about this to my Muslim congregations and audiences, when Islam started, when the Prophet Muhammad taught Islam in Western Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, 1400 years ago, the Egyptians weren't Muslims. The Persians were not Muslims. The people in the subcontinent. But when Islam spread to these societies, it, over a period of one, two, three generations, developed an Egyptian Islamic culture, a Moroccan Islamic culture, a Senegalese, you know, African Islamic culture. The same thing in Persia, in Turkey, in India, etc. So wherever you go in these countries, you will notice the same faith in terms of the prayers and the rituals that we perform. But you'll see a different cultural and institutional formula that developed from the culture of that particular society. Part of the work that we have to do as Muslims immigrating to the West is to do the same thing. We need to develop Islam in America so it's culturally American and it's institutionally American. We need to develop Islam in Australia so it's culturally Australian and institutionally Australian. The same thing in France, the same thing in Germany, the same thing in England. And they will be different because we know that how similar and how different France and England and Germany are. I have to remind you of the wars that they fought against each other, but to show that there's different ideas of how a religious culture is established. But if we do that, if we succeed in doing that, we will have eliminated the risk of this type of a thing. So, for instance, if the Swiss ban minarets, so what? It's not Islamically required. Let's create a new Swiss mosque architecture that doesn't have minarets, and that is aesthetically sound and aesthetically beautiful. I would be happy to see this as part of the diversity of expressions of our faith tradition.
A couple of things from that. One is to go to the faith itself. Christianity, like Islam, has proved rather dynamic over the years, more so than many of its adherents would. Otherwise, it would not have survived in its vigorous forms. Christianity has managed to adapt its handling of the book in such a way as the book can be translated into many languages. Some would say of Islam, at the core of Islam is the book. The book cannot be translated. It is there as the word of the prophet. This creates difficulties in two areas. One, in modernity. How does it come to terms with science? How do you read the Genesis story? How do you read the Adam and Eve story? That's a problem for fundamental Christianity in the West. It becomes a problem for Islam, for some. The book itself, to what extent does that carry an Arabic culture with it? Ultimately, Islam has to be in some ways Arabic.
This is a modern phenomenon. With the power and rise of, let's say, certain countries, especially like Saudi Arabia, as custodian of the two holy sites, etc., and their wealth has increased the idea of an Arab culture associated with Islam. This is not part of our history. If you go to Egypt, you go to Senegal, you'll see a Senegalese expression of Islam. And this is the very point I was making. And this diversity is fundamental to our faith. We are not an Arab religion. God is not an Arab. And Islam succeeded in countries like Pakistan and Indonesia and Malaysia, not because the Malaysians saw it as an Arab religion. In fact, Malaysia is the only country in the world where the constitution of Malaysia states that a Malay is a Muslim constitutionally. The Arabs do not even have that. So if the Pakistanis do not feel that Islam is an Arab religion. They think of it as a Pakistani religion. It is their own faith. It's when the faith takes root in that manner in a society. There are many Christians, for example, in Europe who do not even realize. They think of Christianity as their French religion. It's the Church of England, not the Church of Palestine. Okay, although, I mean, people don't even think of Jesus as being a Palestinian or born in, you know, in that part of the world. There's a famous story, I think, of a Christian scholar who went back and told his mother, a devout Christian, that, you know, Jesus was a Jew. It's nonsense. What are you talking about? Jesus was a Christian. So the terminology we use and the cultural understandings are very important. This is the point I was making. When we develop a sense that Islam is a part of the Australian fabric, then we will not have this problem anymore.
Well, I guess the question I was asking was how dynamic, how flexible, and you're saying far more flexible than people
yes.
conventionally perceive, even people within the tradition.
Indeed. The problem we have is not so much, the other questions you raised was with the question of the book and interpretation. The problem that I see that we have in what we call the Muslim world is not the issue of interpretation. The real problem we have is a fundamental core problem, is that Muslims today in much of the Muslim countries, even those that call themselves Islamic states, are not practicing the ideals of Islam. I mean, Christians know what the golden rule is, the teachings of Jesus was, but you had the Inquisition, where people who are responsible for the religion did not act according to the precepts of Jesus Christ. This is the fundamental problem we have in the Muslim world today. Muslims today are not practicing the teachings, the commandments that God has commanded us to be a just people, to be a just, to do justice, and not to be unjust.
This is a global problem for many of the faith traditions as they move across previously deeply held indigenous traditions as well, because the indigenous traditions are caught up in the new faith tradition. Christianity absorbed Viking culture, Christianity absorbed other things. So many of those old, what the Christians would call pagan traditions, survive in their own localities. In Africa, for example, Nigeria, both Muslims and Christians would have problems with some of the local ethnic tribal cultures. There's female genital mutilation.
Right.
And the difficulty, as we've said earlier, is to distinguish what's essentially locally, culturally based and what's integral to the faith.
Right. And part of the problem that happened in Islamic thinking, the reason why Muslims think certain things, is that the Islamic jurists, you know, who developed the law, the jurisprudence of Islam, stated that they recognized that there were certain commandments in the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet which had to be fulfilled. But anything that was not in conflict with that was deemed to be compliant with the law or not against the law. I mean, I don't know if you have the same thing in America. In America, we have the Constitution, and when Congress enacts laws, people say, is it constitutional, is it unconstitutional?
I think the legal maxim is silence gives consent.
Yes, but the notion of it being constitutional, that frame, that terminology, does not mean that that law is found in the Constitution. Now, what Islamic jurists did the same thing. They said if a law of a culture, a custom, is not in contradiction with the Quranic commandment or commandment of the Prophet, it is shara'i. It means it is constitutional in Islamic terminology. Now, many people now have taken that term and have believed that this particular norm, which may have been a norm of a culture of a particular country at a particular time in the past, is actually a Quranic requirement, and it is not a requirement. That's one of the things that we need to educate our Muslim populations on as well, which is causing a lot of problems. Like the minaret is one minor example of that, where something developed and people think it is part of fundamental to our faith when it is not.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest is Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf. We're talking about his work for Muslim-Christian dialogue, and particularly the Cordoba Initiative. Let's talk of the Cordoba Initiative for the moment. The Cordoba Initiative harks back to a period in history when, in Spain, Muslim, Christian, Jewish culture reached a very rich point of interchange, exchange. Indeed, many of the great texts of ancient Greece were recovered and enriched each of those civilizations enormously. That's a pretty ambitious title to incorporate into your wish list.
We have to be ambitious because we either have to get it right, and we can't be slightly right. We have to get it right, otherwise we will not get to where we want to be. And Cordoba, the Cordoba Caliphate, which reached its peak from the roughly the 800s to the 1200s of the Common Era, was a time, as he pointed out, John, where Muslims, Christians, and Jews live together. But more importantly, as you also pointed out, was a time when a knowledge exchange occurred. The Muslims had, up until that time, had translated and preserved all the Greek writings and Indian philosophy and added to it during their civilization. And then this was a time when it was transferred to Europe. So this major knowledge exchange, which also resulted in kick-starting the Enlightenment, and according to some other scholars, even resulted in the Reformation of Martin Luther, the idea of that there'll be no intermediary between you and reading the Bible, was something which Christians then noticed was very much part of the Islamic practice. And what we need today is what the Cordoba Initiative is, which I founded in 2003, a multi-faith initiative to help erase these problems that we see in the world today, and to fashion, not just to talk about the problems, but to fashion a new global world order that is relevant and appropriate for the kind of harmony we need in this day and age.
What are some of the positive things you're doing? Would you give us an example of some of the program ambitions you have?
Well, our programs were divided after analysis of the causes of the conflicts, which what people call the conflicts between the West and the Muslim world, quote unquote. We identified them into the political arena, political conflicts, which most of you know, Israel-Palestine, U.S.-Iran relations, U.S. Presence, military forces in not only in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and plenty of forces in the region, which has caused a lot of the conflicts. Also, the societal issues, which he's talked about, of immigrant communities, changing demographics, the role of the media in contributing to or either contributing or solving these problems, and the role of religious interpretation. So we have a number of projects, apart from private sector diplomacy, which I'm also involved in. We have our Muslim Leaders of Tomorrow project, which networks growing numbers of very, very accomplished, very bright young men and women, typically in their 30s, but as early as mid-20s to early 40s, who we believe could be the harbinger or harbinger of a new future and a new tomorrow. Our WISE project, a women's initiative in spirituality and equity, which addresses the issues of gender justice and gender equity in the Muslim world, is another one of our very major projects, which is growing and generating a lot of excitement, not only by Muslim women, but even by non-Muslim women who love to see their sisters. It was amazing for me when my wife, Daisy Khan, who is managing these projects, met with people like Gloria Steinem and Sister Joan Chittister, who was here, and they say, well, you know, we're behind you, and give us our marching orders, and we went through the same thing in the churches and the synagogues, and we know exactly what you're talking about. It's an amazing thing to see. But we believe that these are among the things. Another project I'm working on with notable Muslim scholars of Islamic law is to address the issue of what does an Islamic state mean from the point of view of Islamic law and jurisprudence. We've developed the principles already, because there's a lot of agreement and consensus on that. But our next step, which is the more difficult and challenging step, is to create a system of measuring these principles and then rating countries by how well they comply with these principles. Because I know, for instance, that Australia, the United States, and many of these countries actually comply with many of the line items of what makes a state Islamic better than some of our traditional Islamic countries. So this is an example of the types of projects that we do and the work that we're doing, in addition to interfaith dialogue and the numerous other things that we do.
Well, let's talk about the state issue for a moment. You referred to the American Constitution. Here's a constitution that seems to embody Enlightenment principles about religion. That is, it emphasizes the freedom to do rather than the injunction not to do. And you highlighted some important points when you were talking to a plenary session here at the Parliament of the World's Religions about the way in which a constitution such as the United States can be a practical example of where to go on these things.
Indeed. What many people do not realize is that the American Declaration of Independence was established to protect religious freedoms in what was then the Western society, because people didn't have that freedom in Europe at that time. But what people also do not recognize is that the American Declaration provides a religious basis for that. It states, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and of course that is a equality of men was not something that was common in much of the world.
It certainly wasn't self-evident.
Not indeed. But it's something which our religions teach us. And then he goes on to say that all men are created equal, endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and property. And then property was edited, changed to pursuit of happiness. Now, the notion that these rights are given to us by a Creator is a religious idea. It is actually a deist, as they call themselves at that time. They didn't believe in the church so much, but they believed in the concept of a God and that we're creatures of a Creator. So it is a very, very, it's an existential view which is completely in sync with Islamic thought and Islamic existential point of view. In fact, 7 centuries before that, Islamic jurists wrote that all of Sharia, all of Islamic law, is to protect and further, some say 5, some say 6, human rights, 6 objectives of the law, to protect and further religion, life, dignity or honor, your lineage or family, your property, and your mind. And as I've said to many American audiences, life is life, common to both. Liberty and honor and dignity are pretty much the same thing. And what do you do when you want to pursue your happiness? You pursue property, you pursue family, you pursue your religion, and you pursue your intellectual pursuits. What else is left? Pretty much nothing. And that's why I argue that America is a Sharia-compliant state, which shocks many Americans, by the way.
The difficulty is, of course, when it comes down to teasing out how the moral injunctions, the moral imperatives, the moral aspirations can be teased away from the exercise of the law, that is, how the law is implemented. The Christian civilizations went through a couple of hundred years of wars following the Reformation to sort this out, to sort out what it means to separate church and state. This is, in some ways, a process that is still being worked through in Islam?
Well, first let me make a distinction that my friend Professor Ali Mazruri pointed out a number of years ago. We need to distinguish between 2 different things, separation of church and state and separation of religion and politics. As he pointed out, England has no separation of church and state. The Queen is the head of the Church of England, and the Parliament, in fact, Jack Straw, a number of years ago, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, said, I don't know why you Americans have this thing about separation of church and state. I appoint bishops. What's the big deal? You know, he was trying to point out. So he said, and however, in England, there's a very clear, distinct separation between religion and politics. Now, the opposite example of that, he said, is India, where you have an official separation between, let's say, religion and temple, but there's no separation between religion and politics at all. And the United States, he suggested, was some kind of an intermediate place between those two opposite examples. So that's an important thing to factor, that separation of church and state is not a necessary requirement, rather it is, we need to understand what it means when you unpack it. And to me, the biggest definition of separation of church and state, as we understand it in America, is that the coercive powers of the state may not be used to further any religion or religious interpretation over another. That is something which I, as a Muslim, believe in. I believe that my Quran teaches that, that the Quranic verse, which says, there shall be no compulsion in religion, is a distinct assertion for the freedom of the human individual to their conscience, freedom of conscience or freedom of religion, as you may describe it. Now, the issue, the unfinished business in the Muslim world, as I see it, is crafting that position from the point of view of Islamic law and jurisprudence. And the way I phrase it to my Muslim audiences is, what is the right balance of power? Because we use this concept in America, the American concept of checks and balances on the different centers of power. And of course, in the United States, we had the executive branch of the president, the judiciary, the Supreme Court, and the courts in general, and the legislature, which is the Congress. But there are other centers of power as well, and the certain religion and church is one of them. And what we need to do in the Muslim world is to define the right balance of power between institutions of political power and authority and institutions of religious power and authority. And also, there are new centers of power that we have in the modern world today that need to be separated in the Muslim world. These are the military, great power. But in the United States, you can never imagine, you know, Colin Powell or General Petraeus saying, you know, these jerks over on the other side of the Potomac, you know, let's just go and take over and run the government better. You have a distinct separation of power between the military and the governance. You have a separation of power of the central bank. You will never have the President Obama saying, you know, guys, raise interest rates or low interest rates by a point so I can win the next election. He may appoint the governor, but he doesn't have the power to impose monetary policy or fiscal policy, monetary policy upon the central bank. So these centers of powers and these separations are some things which we certainly need in many Muslim countries today.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Our guest is Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, and we're speaking about Islam and the West. Imam Faisal, we're coming to the end of our discussion, but I'd like to pick up on something that we began with, and we talked about the fear of the other. Some of that fear in Western societies relates these days to a certain uncertainty in the West about what the West is. So, for example, when one was talking about Western communities, internally in the West, there is a different view of the relationship of religion and society to what there may be in Australia or in Europe. Religious attendance is very low in Europe. In America, it's quite high. Some Christian communities would want to say that their principal concern is with the secularist trend in their own society, so that there's a tension between secularism and the old Christian deposit within those societies. So this is a multi-layered problem as Islam tries to work out what the West is.
Indeed. You're cutting across a number of different issues, John, here. One is the issue of who we are as a people, and is our identity being eroded in general? You know, are we as Catholics, or we as Muslims, or we as whatever we are, being eroded by the introduction of these other people? But there's another aspect which I think is legitimate to be looked at, and that is values which are different and perhaps at some level mutually exclusive. I understand and recognize Westerners who feel that many Muslims believe that there shall be and should not be any separation of church and state. Take that as one example. Now, you cannot have a situation, let's say in the United States or in Australia, where you have religious freedom and religious coercion. You cannot have that. And there's a fear, legitimately, that I don't want to see happen, that this particular interpretation of Islam, of religious coercion, will begin to come back again. It is just as bad as saying, let's bring the Inquisition back to Christianity. And that's that kind of a fear, I think, ought to be guarded against, and we ought to really build powerful coalitions to filter out those legitimate dangers that I believe can creep in. And I say this because we have seen the radicalization within our communities, especially within the younger ones, whose passion for their community or religious identity is not matched by an equally powerful, sober understanding of the principles of their faith and what a solid professor of mine used to call social dynamite that we are creating. And so as religious spokespeople or as leaders, we need to be on guard against these diseases that have caused us so much pain.
I guess what I'm also saying is that there is a double difficulty. That is, the society in which, will you describe a world in which globalization is moving masses of people across the globe in ways that are absolutely unprecedented. Australia has a problem with refugees who it classes as illegal aliens, boat people, whoever, the fear of the other coming in is still there. But that fear of the other is in part related to an internal uncertainty in the West about who and what it is. And I'm talking about Christian communities in the West who fear that secularists are taking over. So there is a fight there about secularism. So already religious communities feel on the defensive about the secular push in their own societies, let alone having another religious tradition come in. That really creates an enormous problem for those who want to engage in the sort of discussions that you're talking about. And you're seeing it in the eruption, as we said at the beginning, of populist backlash. You have to face that all the time. You can have the Cordoba initiative talking about the sorts of philosophical trends, but at the level of the sort of the street, there are visceral stresses which people feel, which are quite real, because it does mean surrendering of a lot for them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. That is why we're building these networks of women, of young men and women, of scholars, because one of the both pluses and minuses of the Muslims is that we don't have a pope. So we have to go by consensus. We have to create coalitions. We have to create voices that are authoritative without being authoritarian. But being and figuring out the mechanisms by which we can broadcast or make common this kind of knowledge, this kind of perspective and understanding, this is absolutely key.
Imam Faisal, it's been great to have you with us. A really interesting discussion. You presented more challenges than we can deal with in one evening. So thank you for the inspiration.
John, it's been a real pleasure being here in this marvelous city of Melbourne again. I love Australia. I love the Australians. I love everything about Australia, and I look forward to being with you again.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.